Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Hoover Institution's Working Group on the Middle East and the Islamic World for a discussion with the authors of Syrian Requiem, The Civil War and Its Aftermath, Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich and Dr. Carmit Valenci. I'm Russell Berman, co-director of the Working Group. The presentations will be followed by a conversation with H.R. McMaster and myself, and then we will have question and answers from the audience. For the question and answer section, please put your questions in the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. Now our program. Leaving almost 500,000 dead and displacing an estimated 12 million people, the Syrian civil war is a humanitarian catastrophe of unimaginable scale. The book, Syrian Requiem, analyzes the causes and course of this bitter conflict. From its first spark in a peaceful Arab Spring protest that began 10 years ago, to the tenuous Pyrrhic victory of the Assad dictatorship. And it traces how the fighting has reduced Syria to a crisis-ridden vassal state with little prospect of political reform, national reconciliation, or economic reconstruction. Drawing on more than 200 specially conducted interviews with key players, Rabinovich and Valenci assessed the roles of local, regional, and global interests in the war. Local sectarian divisions established the fault lines of the initial conflict, ultimately leading to the rise of the brutal Islamic State. However, Syria rapidly became the stage for proxy warfare between contending regional powers, including Israel, Turkey, and Iran. At the same time, while a war-weary United States attempted to reduce its military involvement in the Middle East, a resurgent Russia regained regional influence by supporting Syrian government forces. Telling the story of the war and its aftermath, Rabinovich and Valenci also examine the considerable potential for renewed conflict and the difficult policy choices facing the United States, Russia, and other powers. Now I have the pleasure to introduce our two authors. Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich is Professor Emeritus at Tel Aviv University, Vice Chair of the Institute of National Security Studies in Tel Aviv, and Distinguished Non-Resident Foreign Policy Fellow at Brookings Institution. He was Israel's Ambassador in Washington, Chief Negotiator with Syria, and President of Tel Aviv University. He is the author, among other books, of Yitzhak Rabin, Soldier, Leader, Statesman, The View from Damascus, State, Political Community, and Foreign Relations in 20th Century Syria, and Israel Facing a New Middle East in Search of a National Security Strategy. Dr. Carmit Valenci, a research fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies, the director of the Syria Research Program, and editor of Strategic Assessment, specializes in the contemporary Middle East, strategic studies, military concepts, and terrorism. She completed her doctorate in the Department of Political Science at Tel Aviv University. Her research focuses on hybrid actors such as Hamas, Hezbollah, and FARC. She holds a BA in Middle East History and Political Science and an MA in Diplomacy Studies from Tel Aviv University. In 2010-2011, she was a research fellow with the Fox Fellowship Program in Regional and International Studies at Yale University. Itamar Carmit, welcome. Please each take 10 minutes now to present your book. Ambassador, please begin.
Thank you very much, Russell. I will deal with the core of the book. The book begins with a historical survey, and then at the end of the book, we have the more contemporary issues with which Carmit will deal later, and I'd like to focus on the three chapters that are the core of the book. They deal with the domestic, regional, and international actors. As Professor Berman has indicated, one of the main reasons for the complexity of the conflict and its perpetuation to the monstrous proportions that it has reached has been the interplay between these levels, the domestic, the regional, and international. What we tried to do was to offer less less of a narrative of different events in the Civil War, which would have taken a long volume by itself, and to focus more on analysis and look at the actors on these three levels. So domestically, it's mostly the regime and his supporters on the one hand, the opposition on the other. In dealing with the regime, we deal with the group of around Assad and with the community, the Alawite community that supports him. This is something that is unique to this part of the Middle East. It's called in English a sectarian issue. The Alawites are an Islamic sect, but this is not just a case of sectarianism. In countries like Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, these communities are also political in nature. This is something that is comparable to, let's say, the Irish Protestant issue in Ireland, where religion also defines politics. And through a complex process that we won't get into, the 12% Alawites in Syria found themselves in control. The Assad family, first the father, then the son, are surrounded by Alawites. And they have their own militias, they control the military, they built a very elaborate system that guarantees their control. In contradistinction to this very tight entity, the opposition has suffered all along from fractiousness. Syria is a diverse country. Diversity has been one of the problems undercutting stability in Syria from day one. And the structure of the opposition reflects this issue. Of course, later on, ISIS was added to the picture, creating in a way a second war. The United States never fought the Assad regime, but it obviously built a coalition to fight ISIS. ISIS also obliterated the border between Syria and Iraq, and for a moment seemed to threaten the whole state system in the core area of the Middle East. In terms of the regional actors, at some point it seemed that it was a conflict by proxy between Iran, the Shiite country, and Saudi Arabia, the chief Sunni Arab state. But soon enough it became more complex. Israel has pretty much been able to keep out of the civil war, although it found itself later on in fact at war with Iran in Syria. Turkey is not just involved, it has actually occupied about or almost 10% of Syria's territory along the Syrian-Turkish border. It is consumed with the Kurdish threat to the very foundation of the Turkish state. Other neighbors are more victims than actors. Jordan and Lebanon are hosting a very large number of Syrian refugees. So is Turkey, and Turkey also is here both victim and offender because it uses the Syrian refugees as a club to hit Europe over the head. Internationally, it's primarily the American-Russian rivalry. Russia has been far more active and effective than the United States. We spend the longest section dealing with any actor on U.S. policy. It's very interesting, it's very important, it's very well documented. And we've had three administrations. The Biden administration is hardly in, but it happened under Obama's watch, and then we had the Trump presidency. And as you indicated, it caught the U.S. as the U.S. was trying to pivot away from the Middle East, certainly not interested in investing in military effort and being drawn into a third military involvement in the Middle East, and unwilling to fight, it has played the game with very inferior cards. Russia once assured by Iran that it won't have to send boots on the ground, that the Iranians will do that. They only have to send the Air Force, who are willing to intervene militarily and have gained a lot of influence. So, three levels, a lot of actors affecting each other and contributing to creating this horrendous problem that seems to have been put on a side burner, on a back burner for now, but threatens to become a major regional and international issue at any moment. Thank you.
Thank you. Carmen, please.
It's great to be here with you. I'm delighted that we can have this conversation, so thank you for that. After 10 years of war in Syria, it is quite clear now that Assad did not win the war, but merely survived it. Assad, a member of the Alawite community, was facing popular uprising by much of the Sunni majority, seemed the next likely victim of the Arab Spring. However, as we all know, and against all chances, he remains the Syrian president. One of the reasons for writing this book was to reflect the question of how Bashar al-Assad, with Russian and Iranian help, survived the war. So the book provides several explanations for that, and I will share with you some of them. Firstly, it was Assad's resilience, ruthlessness, and endless thirst for power. This explains his willingness to use barrel bombs and chemical weapons against his own people and to destroy more than half of his own country in order to secure his position. It also has to do with the weakness and splits of the opposition and the fact that the Free Syrian Army failed to become a coherent, structured alternative. Moreover, secular military groups were overshadowed by Islamist and jihadi groups that become more and more prominent. The emergence of ISIS, of course, is another factor which created a parallel war that overshadowed the original Syrian crisis and basically allowed Assad to create the equation that it's either him or ISIS. But more than anything else, it was Russia's and Iran's effective support in comparison to the ineffectiveness of the opposition's regional and international supporters. More specifically, it was the reluctance of two successive U.S. presidents, Obama and Trump, to be drawn into the Syrian crisis. And this brings me to the current reality in Syria and perhaps to offer some observations about the future of the state. So as the title of the book implies, the Syrian crisis endures. And in our perspective, Syria is unlikely to be put together again anytime soon and would probably remain a divided and unstable country. Assad is entirely dependent on Russia and Iran and faces multiple challenges. Among them is that Syria is still far from functioning as a unified state. Assad controls only 60% of Syria's territory. And even there, it does not have the adequate resources to fully govern those areas. In addition, out of a population of 17 million, more than 6 million internally displaced civilians living in Syria's northwest or northeast, plus 5.6 million Syrians living as refugees in other countries, as we all know. Assad is also to compete with a large number of elements present in Syria who are basically contesting his sovereignty, including Turkey, U.S. forces, internal opposition groups, Kurds, Shiite militias, and ISIS. However, I believe that Assad's most immediate threats are not the rebel factions and the presence of foreign powers. Instead, it is the crushing economic crisis and the impoverished population that is struggling to get enough food. Syria's economy is worse than at any time since the war began in 2011. And of course, it is largely stemming from years of war, but also the result of a deep economic crisis in Lebanon and the Syrian regime's corruption and mismanagement. The situation is that an estimated 90% of the Syrian population today live below the poverty line. We also see broader public criticism on the backdrop of shortage of fuel and bread And there are some indications for lack of trust, even among Assad supporters within the Alawite community. So we can clearly see that the Syrian war has transformed from an intense military conflict into a deep socioeconomic crisis. And, you know, Assad has no easy way out. Ironically, Iran and Russia, which saved him from collapse during the war, lack the ability to save him from a serious economic meltdown. And let me elaborate on these two important actors. Russia, obviously, is the predominant actor today in Syria. Moscow is interested in stabilizing the country and promoting political settlement and reconstruction. However, I think it will be safe to assume that after more than 5 years of intervention, Russia is failing. Russia is failing to turn Syria into a success story or even preventing the country from collapsing. It has to do with the presence of other foreign actors, the hostility of local population, but mainly I think it is the stubbornness of Assad, which are posing major obstacles for Russia. With regard to Iran, at first, the Iranian intervention was rather low-key, but it became more overt during the course of 2013. Since then, Iran has demonstrated a multifaceted entrenchment into the Syrian systems, aiming to penetrate Syria's military, economy, education, society, culture, and so forth. And despite all the challenges and the blows Iran has absorbed, including the economic sanctions, the assassinations of key figures, the Israeli attacks, of course, it's interesting to see that the Iranian entrenchment in Syria continues. It has been done, however, in a slower pace than Iran probably had envisioned and planned, but it continues. From a regional perspective, the regime's improved relationship with several Arab states has been a key part of its quest for return normalization and legitimacy. And although only two Arab states, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, had renewed diplomatic relations with Syria, and as we know, Syria is yet to be readmitted into the Arab League, still its relations with a number of Arab states have improved significantly. So probably we all know, we've recently heard the foreign minister of UAE implicitly criticize the US sanctions, the CSAR Act, arguing that the bigger challenge facing coordination and working with Syria today is the CSAR Act. With regard to the US, to the American policy towards Syria, obviously it had a significant impact on the course of events. However, I would say not because of its proactivity, but as a result of the limited role it played there. So in retrospect, it seemed that the U.S. was preoccupied, I would say, with addressing the consequences of its military intervention in Syria, rather than assessing the consequences of its lack of intervention in the state. The new administration seemed to debate its own strategy with regard to Syria, and that prompted a new debate in American policy and think tank communities about the preferable level, I would say, of U.S. engagement in Syria. Obviously raising questions such as to what will be the focus on issues such as fighting ISIS, dealing with Iran, or whether focus will turn to the political path, including the implementation of Resolution 2254 and addressing the root causes of the crisis. But I'm sure that we will tackle these issues later on. Looking ahead, it seems that there is no future for Syria under Assad. The current regime guarantees chaos, instability, and conflict for many years to come. There is no prospect of political reform and national reconciliation or the return of refugees. A large part of the population does not and probably will not accept Assad as a legitimate ruler. And I would say that Bashar, as of 2021, is a dictator on steroids, obviously more paranoid than he used to be, and probably will continue in his oppression and atrocities, including arrests and disappearances, in order to generate fear and deter the public from further social unrest. Finally, I think that Syria is too important to ignore, and unless the international community will act more assertively in the diplomatic, humanitarian, and economic aspect, we will see a worsening situation, a further economic and humanitarian crisis. That means more refugees, more extremism, and more regional instability. So in other words, the conditions that caused the uprising 10 years ago will only get worse. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Carmen, and thank you again, Itamar. Now I'd like to introduce our Hoover colleague, H.R. McMaster, to join the conversation. H.R. McMaster is the Fouad and Michelle Ajami Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Bernard and Susan Lutow Fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, and lecturer at the School of Business, all at Stanford University. H.R. McMaster was the 26th Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. He served as an active duty U.S. Army officer for 34 years after graduation from the United States Military Academy. His most recent book is Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World. H.R., please, some comments.
Hey, Russell, thank you. And thanks especially for the amazing Middle East program you're running here at Hoover. And thanks to Itamar and Carmen for a wonderful book, okay, and about a terrible subject. But whenever I speak to people now about the Syrian civil war, and they say, well, it seems so confusing to me, I just say, okay, just read this book, because you have described it with such clarity and such insight. And so, Carmen, I was really happy to hear how you closed your comments, because I think what you did is you explained to our viewers why they should care, right? Why do Americans care about the Syrian civil war? And I think, first of all, it is this terrible humanitarian crisis. It has to do with the need to resolve the Syrian civil war. And really the only way to do it, I think, is under 2254, in which really all Syrians would have a say in how they're governed, and therefore remove one of the drivers of this civil war. But then I think really important to Americans is to ensure the enduring defeat of jihadist terrorists, who are the enemies of all civilized people and who want to do our own country and others harm. And then finally, to limit the influence of Russia in a post-Civil War Syria, but especially Iran, especially given Iran's designs to have hegemonic influence in the region, and I think ultimately to put a proxy army on the border of Israel and threaten Israel with destruction. So what I'd like to ask Carmen and Itamar to comment on is, what has been, in your view, the nature of the U.S. response now going into a third administration? And could you critique maybe the approaches of the Obama administration, who I think viewed the Syrian civil war mainly through the lens of the American involvement in Iraq and a strong desire to disengage from the Middle East, and a belief that a disengagement from the Middle East would be an unmitigated good. The Trump administration record, which I think you already alluded to, was mixed, and I had the opportunity to help put into place the policy in early 2018 that articulated the goals that I sort of just summarized there, but endeavored to lay out a sustainable approach to achieving those goals over time, recognizing that the United States was not going to solve serious problems. And now a Biden administration, which also I think might fall into the trap of the Trump administration toward the end. And that trap is to view the Middle East mainly, or maybe only, as a mess to be avoided. And so I just want to read this one short section from your book as a lead in. And this is, I think, is the dilemma that the Biden administration faces and also the Trump administration faced. On page 180, you write, the discrepancy between Trump's persistent desire to disengage from Syria and the national security bureaucracy's quest, I guess I wasn't part of the bureaucracy, I was the national security advisor, but I want to give him options, to retain a U.S. military presence in order to maintain the struggle against the Islamic State, which we should remember was the most destructive terrorist organization in history, but also in order to limit, as I mentioned, Russian and Iranian involvement, has remained an important dimension of U.S. conduct in Syria under the Trump administration. So I think there might be a similar desire, right, obviously, to ensure the enduring defeat of ISIS and other jihadist terrorist organizations, to limit Iranian influence, but it's going to come up against, I think, maybe the president's and others' desire to disengage from the region. But so what is your assessment overall of U.S. administration policies? What are implications for the Biden administration? And what advice would you give President Biden?
Let me start. I'd like to begin by drawing attention to an unusual interview given by President Obama to Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, a few months before he ended his term, explaining his foreign policy. A very large part of it was dedicated to explaining or apologizing for his Syria policy, because I think he understood well that this was going to mar his legacy for years to come, and he wanted his policy to or attitude to be better understood. I found the explanation sometimes to be more disturbing than the policy itself. You mentioned some of the considerations that guided him. I would add another interesting aspect of the policy, the role of the lawyers in the Obama administration. People complained that they wanted to do this and they wanted to do that, but the lawyers explained, you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that. Well, sometimes when you want to manage an international crisis, you cannot do it through the lens of the lawyers advising your administration. With regard to the Biden administration, there was a debate about keeping the 2,000 or so U.S. soldiers in northeast Syria. This actually, compared to what the United States invested in Afghanistan and Iraq, is a very small investment. At a very low cost of casualties to the United States. And it gives you, in addition to what you mentioned, also a place in the table. If Resolution 2254 is ever going to be implemented into a settlement, you need a place at the table. And your presence there and your influence through your Kurdish allies, the SDF, who control more than 20% of Syria, give you very good cards to play at the table.
I would also say about 60% of Syria's oil reserves sit under that 20% of territory.
Right.
And that's resources that anyone would need to reconstruct the country. So it does give you tremendous leverage. Absolutely.
Exactly. So the policy of the Trump administration was to keep the pressure on the regime to try to make it untenable both for Assad and his Russian and Iranian supporters, satisfactory level of effectiveness. Now, the Biden administration will have to make its own mind. I think they understand that there is a very close nexus between Iran policy and Syria policy. I hope they come up with the right Iran policy and with the right Syria policy that is a derivative, but it's mandatory to find a reasonable solution or at least accommodation to this problem.
U.S. policy towards Syria has a significant impact on the course of events. And, you know, from the very beginning, the U.S. had experienced a dilemma. It did not want to intervene militarily in the conflict, but could also not accept the human tragedy there. Eventually, of course, the U.S. played a leading role in building the international coalition against ISIS. But generally speaking, the U.S. objected to any direct participation in the conflict or direct fighting against Assad. I think that the crucial American decision with regard to Syrian conflict were made by President Obama in 2012 and 2013, when he overruled the plan to arm and train the Free Syrian Army, and when he decided to ignore its own red line and refrain from penalizing Assad for the massive use of chemical weapons against his own people. And that was to be one of the most important turning points of the Syrian crisis, which basically paved the way for Russian military intervention and, of course, inflicted a deadly blow on the Syrian opposition. With regard to Trump, although the president did respond militarily to the regime chemical attacks, I would say that both presidents were reluctant to intervene more forcefully. And we've all remembered the peculiar phone call between Trump and Erdogan when Trump declared that we're leaving, referring to his plan to evacuate the remaining American troops from Syria. Of course, eventually he was convinced to abandon this decision, but that was really interesting move. With regard to Biden administration, I think that the new administration still seems to be debating the right way to approach the Syrian issue. And even if this administration would be reluctant to fully engage in Syria, I believe that it acknowledges that the Syrian file should be corrected. Today, there is a debate about the American role in Syria, which can be concluded in three different approaches. The first one argues that the U.S. should cease its investment in Syria and let Russia and Turkey deal with it. Ambassador Robert Ford is one of the advocates of this approach, arguing that U.S. strategy in Syria failed, and basically that U.S. Lost its leverage there, based on the assumption that long-term U.S. efforts to reconstruct and stabilize post-conflict societies were doomed to fail. In addition, Syria has never been a major U.S. national security issue. The second approach basically called for adopting a soft line towards Assad, accepting the fact that he remains in power, and, you know, try to work with it. That means easing the sanctions and offering some benefits in exchange of minimal and necessary concessions. And finally, there is another approach which argues that Syria still matters. There is no solution other than regime change, even not by not saying it explicitly, and by continuing the pressure on Assad and hoping that it will crack down under this pressure. I think that, you know, the first priority of the Biden administration should be to declare clearly that the United States remains committed to the objective of transition of power in Syria and will no longer stand by while Assad, Russia, and Iran commit war crimes and crimes against humanity there. I believe that Biden administration must take a firm decision to put Syria high on its agenda.
Let me intervene here. U.S. foreign policy could be conceived of as, in terms of a possible response to the tragedy on the ground in Syria. But Syria is also a site of the United States facing two important competitors, Iran and Russia. How are Iran and Russia aligned or not aligned? Is there space between them that the United States could possibly leverage?
Yes, there is. I think the Russians have more limited objectives in Syria. They wanted and obtained, they now have both a naval and an air base. They have influence over the Syrian military. They are the paramount power in Syria. They are not that interested in transforming Syrian society. The Iranians have a far more ambitious plan. Iranians have already taken control of Lebanon via their proxy Hezbollah. Syria is a larger and much more complex country, but they are investing efforts in religious and political and economic terms, trying to gain long-term profound influence over the country. They generate a lot of opposition by Syrians to this. The Russians are not too happy with that. Not so unhappy as to try to push them out, but unhappy enough to allow Israel to pound the Iranians from the air without intervening. It seems to me that it will take a much broader American-Russian understanding that the Biden administration might be contemplating on several issues globally, and to fit Syria into the scheme of such a broader Russian-American understanding in order together to find a solution, if not to push Iran out, then at least to minimize its presence and influence.
Carmit, would you like to address this, Russia versus Iran?
Yes, please. So I think that from Moscow's perspective, Iran is a partner who, you know, his interests overlap, but are not identical with the Russians. I think that once Assad had survived the war, its reliance on Iran's boots on the ground basically declined. So Moscow became more and more uneasy with the Iranian entrenchment in Syria, as Itamar mentioned, because you know, the Russian seeks to stabilize the country, and the Iranian entrenchment is in many ways contradict this goal. There are different sources of tensions between these two actors, and I think it's very interesting to talk about. First of all, Russia's desire to maintain proper relations with Israel is a source of tension. You know, Russia promised U.S. and Israel to remove the Iranians to a distance of 80 kilometers from southern Syria, the Golan Heights, and it's struggling to keep up with this commitment. We see on the ground direct confrontation in southern Syria between Russian 8th Brigade, affiliated with the 5th Corps, acts to limit the penetration of the Iranian proxies in the south. They confront with the Syrian regime forces, especially the 4th Division, which, as we know, is under direct Iranian influence. There are also tensions and competition, I would say, between these two actors over the concept of reconstruction. They are eager to gain more and more economic agreements, to sign the agreements with the Syrian regime, in order to gain some profits and to get some revenues after investing so many energy and resources in Syria. And there is a growing criticism in the Iranian press, arguing that basically Assad preferred the Russians, providing more and more economic agreements on the account of the Iranians. And, you know, it's interesting to see that Assad on his side has adopted a sort of a passive neutrality in the competition between these two actors. And he wants to prevent the emergence of a single dominant power in the area, particularly at present time when southern Syria is low on the regime's list of priorities. So it's quite, you know, taking advantage of this competition. But I think that the international community, and most prominently the U.S., should definitely think more thoroughly about this tension and the way that it can exploit the situation.
Thank you. HR, would you like to pose another question before we go to the audience?
Yeah, I would, just to pick up on this theme of Russia and Iran. And you, one of my frustrations, Itamar and Carmit, was in trying to get others to sign up for our approach to Syria, as Secretary Tillerson, you cover this in the book, announced in a speech at the Hoover Institution at Stanford in January, February of 2018, was that really a lot of our partners or a lot of our friends in the region didn't believe it, right? Because they thought we were going to disengage. And what this announcement by the United States that we're disengaging, you mentioned President Trump doing so in 2019 or 2020, early 2020, 2019, I think it was. Even though we don't leave, we lose a tremendous amount of influence by saying that we are going to disengage. And what I saw this manifest was what I would call Putin's Potemkin peace plan, in which Vladimir Putin says to Israel, says to the Gulf states, hey, what I need you to do is to support Assad remaining in power. And in return, what we'll do, what the Russians will do over time, is we'll diminish Iranian influence in that post-Civil War Syria. First of all, it's a lie, right? Because Assad is so reliant on the Iranians. And second, it's a lie because you can't resolve the Syrian civil war with Assad still in power. As you write on page 235, the reasons why you can't resolve with him in power, these include the continuing refusal of significant parts of Syrian society to accept Bashar as a legitimate ruler, the challenge of overcoming the trauma of the disastrous civil war, the enormous difficulties to be faced in reconstruction, and the lingering issue of refugees. The sharp divisions that tore Syrian society apart on the eve of the civil war have only been exacerbated, and Assad is not, and certainly is not perceived to be, a healer. So you say that this is consistent with the contradiction that always existed in the Syrian state, in that a regime that sought to build a strong unified state through a regime predicated on the fervent loyalty of a minority community. So what I would like to ask you is, what would you say to countries in the region who are saying relieve pressure, you know, on the regime, you know, allow Russia to have what it wants in Syria? And you mentioned already, Itamar, our friends, the Emiratis and the Bahrainis. Would you help, I think, make an argument against Putin's Potemkin peace plan and maybe pose an alternative?
Yeah. What Putin would actually like to see in Syria is what I call a Chechenian solution. Namely, you crush the opposition brutally, and then you impose something that looks like a political settlement. So the crushing has been accomplished, but Assad will not offer him even a finger by way of willing to make the slightest concession to the opposition in order to create the appearance of a political settlement. Number two, Assad does not want to take back 5 million refugees because he's quite happy to have a country with a higher percentage of Alawites, a more coherent, quote-unquote, country. And it leaves the ticking time bomb of millions of Syrian refugees in Syria, in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, threatening to go to Europe and destabilize Europe as they have done in 2015, 2016. So, US can use primarily is the insistence that if you don't take back the refugees, if you don't offer a political reform, there will not be money for economic reconstruction, and you will continue in the present sorry state in which you find yourself. So what I would recommend to countries in the region, you know, don't really take the Putin peace plan, quote unquote, seriously or literally. Russia is there to promote its interest, not to promote a healthy solution for the benefit of the region.
Okay, thank you. Carmen, would you like to add anything to this?
I agree with Itamar. I think that the Russian plan is doomed to fail. And, you know, everyone knows that the remaining of Assad will not solve the crisis and will only pave the way for further instability and social unrest. So it's a very short-sighted strategy. And, you know, the Russians are not a big fan of Assad. We should mention that. It was a year ago. It was in last April, when we saw a very interesting criticism in Russian media criticizes Bashar for lack of ability to regain control over the country, criticizing for corruption. So they're not a big fan, and I think we can work with that. The fact that they understand that Assad is, according to their perception, is the only alternative today in Syria, which I believe that, of course, it's not true. But I think we can work with it. I think that the U.S. Cannot ignore the prominent role that Russia plays in the U.S. in Syria. And, you know, thinking about any diplomatic initiative or diplomatic process should definitely include Russia. We cannot ignore its role there. And I think it requires a tighter coordination between the U.S. and Russia with regard to think about the day after Bashar. It's not something that it's completely I think it makes sense. I think there is a probability for offering sort of a deal to Russia, which does not include Assad in the picture.
HR, did you want to add something? Otherwise, we're going to go to the audience.
Just very quickly, because I know we want to get the questions. I just wanted to add, as Carmita said and Tamar said, hey, Russia's in a tough spot here. Assad's in a tough spot. Assad has not won this, right? Russia is desperately trying to get others to write checks to help Russia reconstruct the country it destroyed. We shouldn't do that. So I would just say a way to get to what Carmen is suggesting is a more of an understanding with Russia that to resolve the civil war, Assad has to go. The way to do that is to keep the pressure on associated with the Caesar Act and the other, I think, very important initiatives of the Trump administration. I just wanted to add that as we go to questions.
Okay, so we have a long list of questions. We won't be able to get to them all. I'm going to try to combine some of them, but the first one had to do with this question of dependency on Russia for economic support. Norman Namark writes, the country was horribly poor before the war. Moscow does not have the resources to rebuild anyone's economy. How can the economic crisis be resolved in Syria?
The economic crisis can be resolved in Syria only by the influx of money from Western countries like the United States and Europe, from international institutions, and from wealthy Gulf countries, all of which require green light from Washington. And as I fully agree with HR, General McMaster, namely you need to keep the pressure. This is the main leverage that you have, and you should use it fully. Economic recovery will require return of refugees and political reform.
And political reform means Bashar's disappearance. It means some succession. He seems to be resistant to that. Huh? What's the next step?
Well, you don't have to begin by going all the way and requiring that he move, but at least to create functioning institutions. Of course, the Syrians and the Russians are experts at creating the facade of constitutional framework that hides thinly veiled dictatorship. That we should be aware of that. But that's a beginning. I think if you insist on having Assad removed from power as a first step, Russia will not accept that. So you may have to begin more modestly and continue the pressure.
We have a number of questions about the Kurds. What's their situation now in Syria? What should the U.S. Relationship to the YPG be? And how does that complicate our relationship with NATO ally Turkey?
I would say that it was the rise of ISIS in 2013 and mostly 2014 that finally drew the Syrian Kurds into the Syrian civil war, not as opponents of the regime, but as a defender of its of their own territory. And, you know, the Kurds were building their territorial state. ISIS, declared the caliphate. Focused its earlier effort in eastern and northern Syria, and began to attack and occupy Kurdish areas. And you know, the Kurdish defensive effort was led by the PYD and its militia, the YPG. And from Washington perspective, the YPG and the SDF, of course, was the single most effective local force in fighting ISIS. The Kurds were the one to provide the boots on the ground. So the United States could limit itself to using air power. At some point, the Kurds, both directly and through the SDF, controlled more than 25% of Syria's territory. And again, I'm going back to President Trump's decision in December 2018 to withdraw his troops from Syria, really posed a question mark as to the future of Syrian Kurds. Again, a withdrawal from this decision. And decided to keep the American troops there. And I think it's of course, it's very beneficial for the Kurds in eastern Syria, which are still need protection from the by the U.S.
But this close relationship with the YPG complicates the United States' relationship with a NATO ally. How should we be balancing these two concerns?
It's a dilemma. I cannot deny the depth of this dilemma, because the Kurds were very loyal and effective partners. They were the best fighting force on the ground against ISIS. And, you know, not to abandon allies should be a guiding principle for a major superpower like the United States. It's a moral issue. And it's a practical issue, because in the next war, potential allies will remember how the United States would have abandoned the Kurds. Now, Turkey is a NATO ally, but it's a very problematic NATO ally. It's a NATO ally that buys Soviet anti-aircraft missiles, that has a very complex... I think General McMaster and General Allen and others will testify to the difficulty of working with Turkey against ISIS. You can also ask yourself, how did all these ISIS fighters get to Syria? They landed at Istanbul airport and made their way into Syria through Turkish territory, and no one stopped them. So, you know, Turkey is not a very simple, ingenious NATO ally. And, you know, it takes the diplomatic skills of a superpower to balance these two issues. I don't underestimate the difficulty, but people who live in smaller states expect the United States to work miracles sometimes.
If I may just jump in. Mm-hmm. I think that the Syrian theater has demonstrated that alliances do not have to be mutually exclusive. Realpolitik is basically the name of the game, rather than, you know, strict adherence to ideological commitments. So I agree with Itamar. I think that the U.S. can and should maneuver between Turkey and the Kurds while continue supporting this minority, who again appears to be a very reliable ally. So it's not a zero-sum game. I think that the U.S. Can definitely maneuver between these two actors.
And also, Russell, let's bear in mind that ISIS is not necessarily a past phenomenon. I mean, there are indications of resurgence. The regime plays games with ISIS. So cannot be written off as a terminated episode. It's still a present danger.
Let's talk more about the prospects of 2254 and a political solution. What will the role of the Alawites be in a political solution? It's not a negligible minority, very influential. Are they going to give up power?
Who is they? Right now, the Alawite community is also a house divided among itself. Then there was opposition to the Assad clan and to its policies, but because of the civil war, because of the feeling that now there is a blood account between Alawites and Sunnis, and should the Alawites be defeated, there would be a bloodbath. They hang together. It's not a big secret that the U.S. intelligence service and other and European intelligence services have been looking for Alawite generals, people who would be willing to replace the Assads. You know, they are part of the Syrian equation, and they should be part of, they are now a big part of the problem, they should be part of the solution. In more general way, I would say this is not just Syria, it's also Iraq and it's also Lebanon. These are very diverse societies. There has to be a pluralistic political system that doesn't pretend that we are all Arabs and we are all the same. It has to be in Lebanon in the good old days, until the civil war of 75, had a form of consociational democracy where all communities were represented in power. And the same should apply in Lebanon itself, in Syria, and in Iraq. Otherwise, there will never be stability in this core part of the Middle East.
It's a very diverse demographic. Therefore, consociation might be one outcome, confederation another, or even splitting the country. Is splitting Syria a possible outcome?
Splitting Syria is one of the future scenarios that might happen eventually. And, you know, the Russians were the one to raise this option at the very beginning of the war. I think they understood from, again, the very beginning that this is might be the only option. They clearly talked about federation and the division of Syria into sub-entities, the Kurds, Alawites, Sunni, Druze. And there are some groups that support this idea. I have to say that from a conversation that I have been conducting with Syrians, most of them completely oppose the idea of the division of Syria and support the unification and, you know, unified Syria and return Syria to what we used to know prior to 2011. But it seems a bit imaginary. I mean, seems a bit problematic to restore Syria's position as a unified state. And I think more and more, and perhaps even more in the future, we'll hear more voices that argues that this is the only solution, to divide Syria into sub-entities, again, with the remaining of Assad or not, but this is might be the only solution for this fractured state.
Yeah. Federal, I would say federal, not partition, but federal. But, you know, people look at places like Switzerland and even Germany today and say, see how it functions. But remember how many centuries of violence it took for the Swiss to form their federation. Even today, when you speak to a Francophone Swiss and to a German-speaking Swiss about the other, you know, they are not always that polite, but they found a way of living together. So it's not an overnight solution, but ultimately, you know, in Iraq, it's more natural because you have the Kurds in the north, the Shiites in the south, the Sunnis in the northwest. So a federal solution in Iraq is maybe easier to obtain. In Syria, it's a bit more complex, but I can see no other formula long term.
But what about in the interim? Could there be a split between, say, the regime controlled areas and the Kurdish American controlled areas? East Germany, West Germany.
You know, in a way, you could have that, but this would require a modus vivendi with Turkey, because Turkey is a neighboring country. Also, you cannot fully separate the Kurdish issue in Syria from the Kurdish issue in Iraq. It's the same ethnicity, if not nation. This would take not a major military investment, but a major policy investment with people on the ground, and it would require a major dedication and investment on the part of, say, the United States or external powers to make it happen, but theoretically, it's feasible.
Carmet?
Yeah. It does not solve the, it will not solve the problem, the Sunni problem and the Druze. As I mentioned earlier, most of the Sunnis will not accept Assad as a legitimate ruler. So even, you know, dividing the state into two will not solve the problem. And again, will lead to further instability and perhaps even the reemergence of opposition to Assad. So I think a more complicated but a more fair solution is required here.
And Russell, if I could just add two complicated factors. You know, one is to the recognition that, as Itamar has already alluded to, that, you know, the Kurds are not homogeneous or monolithic, right? They're very divided among themselves. Even in eastern Syria, you know, the PYD, YPG does not speak for all the Kurds in that region. You have the Arab minority there. It's a crazy quilt of ethnicities there in the eastern part. And of course, Turkey would see any kind of move toward a Kurdish dominated autonomous region as the first step in the dismantlement of Turkey and the loss of Eastern Anatolia. So, I mean, it's bad enough, I think, as Carmen is saying. I mean, but you know, it always could get worse, and partition could actually make it worse than better in the near term.
Thank you, all three of you. It's complicated. There does not seem to be an auspicious outcome in the near future, but we've learned a lot this morning. I want to congratulate Itamar and Carmit for their very informative book, Syrian Requiem, The Civil War and Its Aftermath. It's published by Princeton University Press. Thank you, HR, for your participation. I want to thank the audience as well. The Working Group on the Middle East and the Islamic World publishes a quarterly caravan of commentary at hoover.org/caravan. Thanks so much. Goodbye.
Thank you.